Welcome back to Monument. The next three episodes will feature people and places of Sussex. In this episode, I'm starting with the Midsummer Oak Tree, standing on the edge of Worthing. More news at the end of the podcast, but for now, I hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. On a little triangular patch of grass, squeezed up against a busy roundabout junction, there's an old oak tree, hollow and squat, with its limbs lopped off. There's a small plaque next to it which identifies the tree as playing host to an unusual story. The story is strange enough, but there's an interesting twist. In 2006, the Highways Agency was about to destroy the tree, having declared it unsafe and too close to the road. The tree's story saved it. This episode explores the story of the Midsummer Tree and the people who have told it and retold it over time, rooting it to the earth like the old tree itself.
This tree believed to be over 300 years old. It was once celebrated in the local folklore every year at Summer's Eve. It was believed that the skeletons would rise up from its roots and dance around, rattling their own bones until daybreak.
Where do stories like this come from? What makes them endure? I met up with Jacqueline Simpson, researcher and author on folklore and legends. Jacqueline is an expert and lives just a couple of miles from the Midsummer Oak.
Yes, you got interested in the tree on Broadwater Green, didn't you?
That's right. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Now, the background to that is that the earliest study of Sussex folklore was by Charlotte Latham in 1878, and she says that there's a tree that beside the path leading downs from Findon towards Worthing is an old tree, and skeletons come out from under its roots and dance. Charlotte Latham says that this tree is by the lane leading to Worthing, fair enough, at the foot of the downs. Now, I would hardly call Broadwater Green the foot of the downs. On the other hand, there's been so much building and changing of the landscape, I'm not going to argue over that. And that has now been accepted locally as being the tree that Charlotte Latham meant, and therefore the centre of this story about skeletons coming out and dancing round it on Midsummer's Eve. Apparently, some people in Broadwater call it the hanging tree, which would make sense because if it was a tree where people were hanged, their bones would be likely to be buried at the foot of the tree, which would then lead on to this nice idea of skeletons coming out. Whatever the truth of the matter is, it's now well accepted locally as being a centre for folk tales. And on Midsummer's Eve, people gather there and tell stories and sing folk songs and dance round the tree. I've been there, so my dancing days are past. I stand and watch. I have great respect for Charlotte Latham. She was a clergyman's widow, and she has one anecdote which I think is absolutely charming. She was taking a Sunday school class, and they were using a text which referred to the devil as our spiritual or our ghostly enemy. and she was trying to explain this to the kids. And they got all terribly excited and said, yes, they knew all about that, and they knew about a man who had sold his soul to the devil. And instead of shutting them up, she just took note of their stories and put them in her article. I admire it because it's so practical. So many folklorists in the late 19th century were obsessed with theories. They were always trying to prove that something was prehistoric, or that it was a relic of sun worship, or that it was a relic of ancestor worship. Charlotte Latham simply got on with saying, this is what happens. And of course, therefore, her work has endured, whereas their theory-laden stuff has sunk most of it.
How much are these folklore stories, how much do you consider them stories for children?
Now, yes, but couple of hundred years ago, no, for the whole community.
And do you have a sense of what purpose they, you know, why were they being told?
Well, I think the answer might very well differ. Some stories are obviously warnings. Don't go near that pool. And religious warnings, dreadful things that have happened to people who went fishing on a Sunday. And they are a response to the mysteriousness of some locations. It's about making it important. There's something different about this. We can claim this as our story. And hey, listen, isn't it interesting? Isn't it gruesome? Isn't it funny? As the case may be. I think folk imagination does rather tend towards the gruesome and melodramatic. I know my own mind does, and I do seem to see similar traits.
I asked Jacqueline about stories and what part they play in the way we think about places.
They can certainly change the attitude of the public towards the place. And then, of course, it changes expectations.
How much does a place make a story, or how much does a story make a place for you?
I think the place makes the story, plus the expectations people have of that sort of place. The obvious example would be the standing stone somewhere where there are no other standing stones. How did it get there? Must have been thrown or dropped. Who would be capable of throwing or dropping a big thing like that? Perhaps a giant, perhaps the devil. But you don't ascribe it to the good Lord God, because he only makes things that are useful. And a stone in the middle of a field is not useful.
Studying stories, you need to have an idea, have an understanding of truth, which is quite fluid, I suppose.
Indeed, yes. One of the great joys of studying folklore is that you needn't worry about facts. So long as someone has said it somewhere, sometime, it is to that extent current. Yes, I have a very fluid approach to facts.
And do you think there are... Do you find that there's a big separation between archaeology and that kind of study of the past, and then the study of stories and folklore?
Yes. Less so now than there was, but at one time archaeologists never recorded any of the stories they were told about the site. They were purely factual. Yes, it is quite different. Archaeologists are concerned with provable fact, and folklorists absolutely not. in fact, if it's a provable fact, we're inclined to say, no, that doesn't concern us.
What happened to the story after Charlotte publishes her leaflet in 1878? How does it resurface in 2006 to save that particular tree on Grove Lodge roundabout? Jacqueline, give me my next lead.
And Chris Hare found the local people around Broadwater thought that this was the tree on Broadwater Green. Chris is crucial to the development of this story. And whoever his informants were in Broadwater, I don't know how many people he spoke to or what exactly they said, but...
I met up with Chris Hare, a local historian, and asked him to describe how he became involved in the fate of the tree.
So at that time, I was working in Midhurst. So early in the morning, you know, 8 o'clock, 7, 8 o'clock, I'd be driving past there. And I noticed one day it had been severely cut back. You know, I thought, that's brutal. Surely it's going a bit extreme. So I rang up the council and said, you know, what's happened to the tree here? And they said, oh, well, it's been prepared to be felled. Oh, I can't do that. It's the midsummer tree. And I explained all about the background, the history and the folklore. And eventually they put me in touch with the highways agency. Mm. And just by good luck, I spoke to someone there who was sympathetic, you know. I think actually I was off work at the time, so I wasn't in great fettle myself, but I thought this is important. And various phone calls and emails took place. And the long and short of it was decided to have a site meeting at the tree one February morning in, must have been 2006. And we all got there. It was a foul day. But everyone was sort of engaged. That was the great thing. Everyone wanted to try and find a good solution. It was conceded, you know, early on that it had to be cut back because the highways agency had to make sure that all trees near trunk roads were safe. But just how much is going to be cut back? And they wanted to cut it really down to a stump. And I was saying, well, can't you leave that lower branch? I go, well, it won't make much difference. I go, well, yeah, it might do. And they agreed to. And for 2 or 3 years, it just looked like a tree stump with a branch. And then the foliage started growing back. And now, of course, it just, you know, it looks like a proper tree, doesn't it? Big canopy of leaves. And they also put a little plaque there about it, which was good.
We'll leave Chris there for a moment and go to Peter Wish, currently the head gardener at Highdown Gardens. But back then, he was brought in to offer expert advice about conserving the tree.
It's an interesting little bit of land there, and we used to manage it in parks for a number of years, and became aware of the veteran trees on there, very old oak trees. You know, there's quite a collection there. And in fact, the old trees there seem to run through that whole of the Offington area. There's a lot of the houses there have got big old trees, similar age trees to that one, in their gardens. So we were involved in, you know, protecting those with tree preservation orders. But there's some fantastic old trees there. And in my mind, they've always been associated with the old Norman hall there that used to be in Offington Hall. It was an old Norman land holding, and with that then it came the very ancient trees. So the trees there, you know, could well be up to 1,000 years old, and would have been there when the old Norman manor was of Offington was there. It transpired that land, although we were managing it in parks, that little bit there was actually owned by the Highways Agency, because it's a big trunk road there, obviously, nationally important. And of course, their highway engineers came in, had a look, saw it was had a hole in it and it was decaying, and condemned the tree. Yeah, so they were going to just take it out as a for public safety, because in the end, a lot of this comes down to differing views on how you should treat a veteran tree. And there are, you know, that's the quick and simple way is to take it out completely, but there are other measures you could take if you were minded to conserve it. And I think it was Chris Hare, wasn't it? He was the guy who led that, you know, established that it was an important tree and had an important folklore in the area. And so its cultural value really was established beyond doubt. Even if the material tree itself was in, you know, quite a poor condition. And then we discussed then with the Highways Agency's experts and myself about what sort of compromise could be reached. And in the end, you just take the weight out of the tree, take the crown out of it, and then re-establish a nice low crown, which, you know, reduces the risk of failure. Because although we don't believe in spirits and ghosts and things like that, undoubtedly a tree like that has got some, you know, particular importance, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's valued because of its age, you know, just its actual tissue is that old. And so, you know, you can talk about it in that way as if it has got ghosts, because, of course, it has in some sense, you know, it's part of our past, isn't it? Just sitting there now, living on. So it has got that spirit, hasn't it? So and it acts as like a focus for attention, and I suppose that, you know, that is how that folklore builds a little bit of truth, and then a little bit of what people, the values people project onto it, and then it all wraps up together, doesn't it?
The Midsummer Oak is adjacent to a pretty busy road junction, and I wondered about how many people are able to look past that and appreciate a special place, even if it looks unremarkable.
You sort of picked up on it, and I suspect there's quite a lot of people who do. And, you know, particularly older people, perhaps, who lived in Worthing, you know, and seen, you know, the development and the roads get busier and busier and the housing closing in on everything. But yes, it's an interesting way of looking at the landscape, isn't it? Of, you know, trying to strip away the modern sort of accoutrements and sort of dig down to perhaps what it used to look like. And of course, it's the big old trees that are really the main clue, aren't they? The trees in an area, because they're so long lived. And, you know, the first thing we did with the Midsummer tree, when we realised this was a story, was to actually look after its roots, because that's, of course, that is the substance of the tree. It's the basis of it. And so we took away all the weed from around the tree and gave it a good coating of a bark mulch around the tree there to nourish its, the mycorrhiza, which is a sort of fungal community that lives and associated with tree roots. So you look after that, the mycorrhiza and the fungi will be, look after the tree then, and increase its resilience and enable it to carry on for another 1,000 years. So it's, you know, it's very much from a bottom up, you know, you sort of look at the whole tree, not just the top. The UK has more veteran trees than any other European country because of the way we've managed our woodlands and trees quite differently from European methods. So we've got quite a good stock of very old trees in this country.
Yeah.
I think people were beginning to, you know, recognise their value and protect them. I think the appreciation of those, they're part of our living heritage, really, aren't they? You know, the built heritage gets a fair shout with conservation of buildings and monuments and things. And now it's, you know, actually turning around to the natural world as well and coming around to that. And there's some very old structures, albeit they're living structures. You know, these trees can live on for 1,000 years. An oak tree, you know, say it grows up for 300 years and then it grows... it sits for 300 years and then it grows down for 300 years.
Oh,
so there's
right.
your 1,000-year life cycle
for
an oak, just summarised. It's just a shame now because we're going to lose a lot of the ash trees, you know, with this ash dieback.
Yeah.
Which is in the area.
Yeah.
And it's going to gradually knock out all our ash trees, which is going to be a bit of a shame. Been through it all with the elm trees, haven't we? And now a similar story is going to play out with the ash.
How is it spread then?
Fungal spores, yeah, yeah. It's spreading naturally, but, you know, I'm not sure where it arose from initially. There's nothing you can do. There's
yeah.
nothing we can do to stop it spreading. You know, it's going to be, yeah. So that's going to be the next big effect on the English landscape is the loss of ash trees. Hopefully there will be some trees in the population that will be resistant to it and they can re-establish then from their genetics, the you know, a new strain of it, yeah. But I think, you know, that is in the long term. In the short term, we're going to just lose a lot of tree cover.
With all the popular attention on the environment issues at the moment, I wonder how many people know about this disease that is expected to wipe out 90% of all ash trees, equivalent to 1/5 of our national woodlands. Coming back to the midsummer oak, how has it continued to flourish with its hollowed out decayed trunk? I learned something interesting from Peter.
And in fact, the cylinder is a stronger structure than a column. So the fact it's been hollowed out doesn't make that much difference. They were the trees that tended to survive the big gales, were the hollow old trees. They weren't uprooted because, of course, they were a lighter, more flexible structure.
Yeah.
That was able to withstand the wind. And they think that's probably why this hollowing out of these old trees by decay fungus, it does protect them and keeps them, you know, living on much longer than they would if they were just standing undecayed.
I love this idea of growing older and becoming hollowed out as a piece of self-protection. We come back to Chris Hare now, on the brink of saving the midsummer oak from removal. But there's one more piece of the story to tell.
And so you're seeing this tree that you recognise as the midsummer tree.
Mm.
And so how have you come to...
That conclusion.
To that conclusion.
Yeah. So through Jacqueline Simpson's book, Folklore of Sussex, that's how I first read about it. And she got her information from a little book called West Sussex Superstitions Lingering in 1868, that was written by a lady called Charlotte Latham. And so she remembered about the midsummer tree from when she was a girl, like in the 1820s. And then when she was writing it, she was introduced to certain people who knew the story, including one man who was supposed to have seen these skeletons rise up from the roots and do their dance as he passed by at the point of midnight. We knew sort of where it was, but not exactly where it was. And the person who identified it precisely to me was Wilf Page, who was the landlord of the Cricketers pub. And his father had been the landlord before him, and his grandfather before that, and maybe even one generation before that. I know that they took over in 1878, and Wilf died about 1989, I think. And so he said, yeah, that's it, that's the tree. So that was good enough for me. And of course, interestingly, it now looks more mysterious and intriguing now than it did before it was cut back. So it's sort of, you know, everyone knows exactly what tree it is because it stands out from all the ones around it.
It's become fixed now, it's something that I was kind of realised, I suppose, through talking to Jacqueline, was this relaxed attitude towards the truth that exists within folklore.
Yeah, well, because folklore isn't history. And the whole point of folklore is it's a movable feast. It's not about facts. It's about beliefs. It's about feelings. Mm. If it's a story that's been kept alive for generations and generations, it becomes real in a sense. So, of course, with the tree, yeah, you know, Wilf Page could have got it wrong. Or he could have just decided that's the tree. Who knows? But we do know that is an old legend, and that tree fits the bill, so why not?
But there's a tension, isn't there, between history and folklore?
But even history isn't really facts. It's just someone looking at the past through the lens of the present and interpreting it. Well, no one can agree about the present,
can they?
No one can agree about Brexit, and we're living in it, but people don't agree. So what's the chance of ever agreeing about what happened in the past?
Yeah.
You know, zero. Yeah. People romanticise the past, particularly the unrecorded past, you know, that's not written about. They can do what they like with it.
Yeah.
and there's no way of proving or disproving. I think what probably has changed is that the transmission from generation to generation has been disrupted. And I'm sure a lot of the alienation there is now in parts of this country and anger is because people don't really feel connected to their past. They don't really know what it is anymore. And that's because of the rapidity of change. It's always been changed, but it's getting faster and faster and faster, so it's harder and harder to keep up with it.
This brings us to the Midsummer Trees reprieve in 2006. 3 years later, Chris Anderson, aka musician Crayola Lecton, visits the tree, having heard about the dancing skeletons. After his visit, he created a piano improvisation inspired by the story and his visit to the tree. That's the tune you can hear now. I asked Chris if other particular locations have inspired him to make music.
Yeah, well, places seem to have a massive sort of effect. When I'm playing music, I'm often thinking about places, and I get to a certain part in the music and there's a place in my head and it's somewhere either possibly where the kernel of the idea was formed when it came to me, often when I was driving. It was doing a driving job that I had lots of time to be listening to my piano parts on headphones when I'm working out arrangements. And so, yes, there was a eureka moment at a roundabout in Crawley next to Asda when it was like, yes! And now every time I get to that part of that song, I'm back at this really, really boring roundabout in Crawley.
Yeah, though, I mean, I like those places. I'm much more drawn to the places that are less obviously, you know, the postcards kind of monument, you know, and those, and that's partly what drew me to the Broadwater Oak, because I'd been past it so many times and I'd seen that little plaque and I didn't really know what the deal was, but obviously there was something significant about it. And then a friend had told me, a friend from Worthing had mentioned that, oh, that tree's got a, you know, supposed to have skeletons rise up.
Yeah.
And I love it.
You've got to dance around it anti-clockwise 7 times or something.
To raise them, yeah.
But there's quite a lot of dancing around things to summon devils and things like that, you know. That's another thing. I mean, I have a completely sort of, I know this is going to sound terrible, quite interested in the devil, but only as an idea. In music, we've got the devil's interval, which is the augmented fourth.
Okay. You know,
it's one of my favourite things. It's based on the whole tone scale. So if you make any music in whole tones, it sounds very, very spooky.
Right.
A lot of horror music and devil-y music.
Yeah.
And And I love that style of music. Debussy was a great proponent of it. And, you know, it's quite limiting, so you have to chuck a few semitones in as well. But I think in medieval times, something, I may be wrong, but I believe, and I have believed for many years, that playing the augmented fourth was kind of punishable for, you know, as for witchcraft, for which, of course, it was the death penalty as well. So I always thought that, say, because a lot of organum, which is our earliest form of music that we can sort of think of, as our first harmonised music, where you've got two notes playing at the same time, was usually in fifths. So, so maybe if there was, like, say, someone was a bit flat when they were singing, say the higher voice, instead of singing that, if they were a bit flat by a semitone, and someone heard it, they could have sort of accused them of witchcraft and killed them. I don't know, you know, it's a dangerous business, music.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, blues and rock and roll has got a lot of sort of devil's interval, because it's sort of all that sort of thing. It's based in a context of deviliness.
We got onto the way we've each managed to stumble across this story and what it means to us today to be intrigued and drawn to places like the Broadwater Tree.
No, it's fascinating, isn't it? And we're just sort of sitting here, this end of the story.
Yeah.
Trying to sort of piece what to, you know, what we can, you know.
It's
an interesting time to be alive, I mean, with the internet, because, I mean, I suppose, you know, we have got podcasts like this one as well, which are going to stimulate people's imaginations, hopefully. But, you know, we can be quite lazy and look everything up on the internet. But I suppose before the internet, there is a wider sort of world of knowledge which hasn't made it onto the internet yet. So the actual real research involves going out and sort of finding the places, talking to the other people who may be too old to have the internet, or researching in local libraries and stuff like that. When I first read about the Broadwater, the Midsummer Tree, I had a sort of, you know, you immediately have a picture of this thing and you think, I've got to go to there, I've got to go to this. So it was a bit of a anti-climax, I suppose. I did see the poor thing.
Yeah.
There's not a lot left of it. And you just got loads of sort of Vauxhall Zephyras driving past it.
Yeah.
It's like totally uncosmic sort of place. Yeah. I think if I was one of the skeletons coming out of the ground, I'd be like, oh God, I wasn't expecting the A27.
I talked about my midsummer sunrise moment at Avebury, waking up and walking through the giant standing stones in the early morning light, and the powerful effect that had on me in terms of how I remember that place.
And I think, you know, you're right, the solstice is an incredible time, and sunrise and sunset generally are incredible times. It's, you're aware of the movement of this great big globe. Or is it a disc? Let's not go there. No, it's not. We've got this thing in our other band, Zoff, where we only release records on sort of cosmic occasions, like the the solstice and stuff like that, all of our stuff has only ever been released on those kind of occasions. So I think that's a nice idea. It's not my idea. It's one of the other people in the band.
Yeah.
But it was... it sort of makes it more meaningful in a way, somehow.
Yeah.
It's born at a time when planets are doing something which I don't really understand, but
it feels slightly sort of arbitrary to in some ways do things like that, isn't it? Because now you have to kind of actively choose to sort of do that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, not that long ago, and presumably for an extraordinarily long time, that is how we were all behaving, you know, in accordance with certain natural cycles and just the things that we had around us to kind of navigate and make sense of the world.
We're surrounded by such a lot of sort of, you know, advertising, things that we're supposed to be thinking about, apparently, or we're told that we need to be sort of mindful about. And it's usually something that someone else will be making money out of or some sort of profit of some description. And we've built all these edifices around us. We must be so out of touch, really. I mean, you know, if I switch the central heating off, you know, for more than a couple of days, I can't bear anything. I mean, you know, what would it have been like 100 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, you know, making fires more, but it's pretty pathetic. It's really important that we have got that ancient thing inside us that does receive information because there's such a lot, there's so many screens between us and that information and blocks in our own minds that are stopping us from receiving it because we're worried about this or we're worried about that or I've got to do that at work and I've, you know, oh, I forgot to do that. Oh, what are they going to, how am I going to tell my boss this? How am I going to do this? And, you know, everything's a problem. And so once you, you know, to actually sort of be able to tunnel your way through all of that to something meaningful is a real gift if you can do it, you know. And I think things like music, art, walking out on the downs, the process of being rather than looking for the end, the rhythm of walking on ancient land, everything's ancient land, you know, even when you're walking in Tesco's, I mean, that's ancient underneath it, you know, but you can't feel it when you're in there, you know, that's what I mean. It's like, so actually, there are so many filters that have, that our culture has thrown up to sort of put us off the scent.
I thought this podcast was about place, but, you know, it's like places don't exist in isolation and, you know, monuments like a standing stone or a waterfall or a tree, it's just a tree unless you invest your kind of curiosity in it, I suppose.
Totally. It's there must be so many places of great significance pretty well everywhere. And just driving along the road, I'm just aware of all the times I've been driving along the road and all aware of all of the fatal accidents that have happened along that road over the only, say, 20 or 30 years that I've been driving there, but all of the hundreds of people that have been affected by those accidents. Mm. All those little tiny places along the A27 are of great significance.
Yeah.
They're sacred.
Yeah. You know,
for want of if that's a strong word, but I suppose in a way that is sacred, isn't it? Every time I sort of drive through there, I just think of not the people that died, but the sort of the significance of the place to so many other people. Mm. And it's, of course, again, it's the most boring thing in the world. It's like that Asda roundabout in Crawley, which whenever I get to this certain part of this certain song that I play, when it gets really exciting, I've got the most boring picture in my head of this gimming thing. Yeah. Such a shame. It should be sort of some kind of wonderful sort of utopian landscape. But yeah, locations, and locations in the mind as well. I think that's what this is all about.
So that's about it for this episode. Thank you to everyone who's contributed. Thank you Chris Anderson, Chris Hare, Peter Wish, Jacqueline Simpson, and of course for Zeno reading out the story at the start of the podcast. In the next episode, I'll be visiting a Sussex landmark, Chanctonbury Ring, a hilltop site and an important place for Celts, Romans and just about everyone down through time to the present day. That should be published in about 1 month from now, so if you're interested in this sort of thing, please subscribe through your podcast app. Also, I've been pretty busy with the website, monumentpodcast.com. Have a look on there for a short animation I've made about the Midsummer Tree, and also for the first issue of the Monument Podcast zine. The music in this episode is provided by Adrian Rhodes and Crayola Lecton. Links in the description to the podcast. For now, thanks for listening, and thank you to Arts Council England and Ada and Worthing Trust for supporting this podcast.